Welcome to our podcast.
If you enjoy this segment, we encourage you to check out the others. Also, if you're new to Hedgeye, you qualify for a special discount on one of our Hedgeye investing products. Email customer service director Matt Moran at mmoran@hedgeye.com. That's mmoran@hedgeye.com.
I'm Keith McCullough. Welcome back with the one and only Lizanne Saunders, who's not feeling very good today. She looks great, so don't looks can be deceiving here. I think you got some hot flu stuff in there.
Maybe you hear me, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So we'll try to do our best, Lady Gaga, Bradley Cooper in the Shallows song, maybe.
Like
we'll
yeah.
sound like deep
yeah,
and
exactly.
you know, raspy, so. And she still has her market views, so we're going to get into that. And certainly load the questions up, because this one's going to be a shorter one, because I don't want to have to have her endure being here too long.
I may be mute at that point anyway. So let's see how much we can get through.
Yeah, for sure. Well, let's start with just the FOMO. I mean, I don't know how you deal with it. I was saying in a couple other segments, like some mornings I feel like I'm going a little crazy.
Yeah.
Just watching. Yeah, we're doing all of our rate of change measuring, mapping, bean counting. Actually, a great bean deal out there on the tape now. But people are just can't help themselves. And both my institutional clients, and you deal with both the mass market as well. Just a sincere FOMO, I guess, is I want to get your reaction to that.
So I actually think it's a little bit less on the retail investor side than what might be suggested by looking at the daily action.
Yeah.
I think a lot of this, as you well know, has to do with the mechanics of the market and machines. And it does tend to eventually trigger more on the attitudinal side of sentiment than on the behavioral side of sentiment, at least what we see. And it been very distinct periods where, and this is more anecdotal than anything else, I live on the road and speak to our clients all the time. And I'm not exaggerating the months here, but the months where sentiment started to get really frothy were January of 18, September of 18, April of 19, July of 19, and then again in September of 19.
That's a lot.
It's a lot, but it was also right at the point where we were sort of in a little bit of an uh-oh, or in the case of the fourth quarter last year, a big uh-oh. And I see it, interestingly, on Twitter, too.
Yeah.
And my next project, when I can find time, is to see if I can actually construct a Twitter-based sentiment indicator.
Yeah.
Because people, for some reason, have been labeling me a perma-bear. I'm not a perma-bear by any means.
No.
You know, we do make tactical recommendations, and 2 years ago, we went from having been overweight U.S. equities from the beginning of 2009, the whole time, to neutral.
Yeah.
That just means we're telling our clients, stay at your normal long-term strategic asset allocation, and within that, we went to overweight large cap, underweight small cap. So the tactical performance has been good.
But and went long utilities and REITs. We
upped our ratings on utilities and REITs and said this is going to be more of a risk-off, defensive-oriented type market environment. And we've also been saying that factors probably will be more persistent in leadership than sectors.
Mm-hmm.
Which is another reason why generally we're somewhat neutral in sectors.
I mean, people, unless they're measuring and mapping it on their own or just looking at the returns, I mean, high beta, for example, in the last 1 and 3 months has been a train wreck relative to things that you could have been in.
Right.
And I wonder, on that, like we call it full cycle investing, but clearly the U.S. economic cycle peaked in Q3 of last year. GDP, inflation, and profits, pretty straight up peak.
Yeah.
How many clients do you see are actually cognizant of the returns that have been made in a portfolio that's long treasuries, gold, silver, utilities, platinum, it could even be. REITs have been up over 20% over that period. Is that a known known, or is this something that maybe people chase at the end?
I don't think it's a known known. But some of it has to do with the fact that most of the investors that sort of I circle around when I'm traveling have much more of a long-term strategic approach. They're not the short-term traders. They're not performance chasers. They actually do believe in things like long-term diversification, strategic asset allocation. But I can look at some of the flow data, and certainly in some of what you mentioned, precious metals, there has been a bit more sort of hype on the part of investors.
Yep.
But for the most part, the more of an advised relationship our investors have with us, the less performance chasing oriented they tend to be, and they're ultimately kind of happier at whatever point in, mm-hmm. in the cycle we are.
Yeah, on the institutional side, I'd say people are not. I mean, they're either extremely happy or just not happy at all because their fund is going away. I mean, you also have that career risk management setup that I could clearly see in my inbox. That's more of a discreet messaging, but I could see it. On, you know, like you said, at the end of September last year, at the end of July of this year, clearly people sitting there saying, "Oh my God, I got to get you know out of those bond proxies right. yep. and into growth or something." The hardest thing that I have rationalizing that pivot for me, I mean, going towards a different quadrant, for example, is buying something into a big decel to negative year-over-year earnings. You guys have done a bunch of work on it. Like, how do you look at the cycles historically when you're about to go from peak earnings to, oh, it's still good, oh, you're saying there's a chance, to now down, like we think they could be down 5 to 8 right. year-over-year S&P earnings. Like, do you want to buy during that, into
well,
that, or not?
I think you not only have to have some confidence in the forward look to earnings, which I think is particularly tricky in this environment because, although, as you know, I don't look at individual stocks. I don't analyze right. individual stocks. I don't tend to speak individually to the analyst community, but I'm broadly aware. And, you know, there's very little sense that any adjustments to 2020 have been made specific to the trade war. Mm-hmm. That all of us are sort of sitting in a waiting mode mm-hmm. To get a sense, certainly, of whether the December 15th tariffs kick in.
Yeah.
Because of the bias toward more consumer-oriented goods, that's important in terms of the outlook. But I think the last 2 years, as you know, has been interesting with regard to earnings. And the second part of my answer is you have to have an assessment of the macro environment, too. It's mm-hmm. not just the trajectory of earnings, because 2018 was obviously a great year for the E part of the equation, but multiples were under compression the entire time because mm-hmm. the Fed was tightening, financial conditions were tightening, so that put downward pressure on multiples. Complete mirror image of 2019, you yep. lost virtually all the E, but you've had upward multiple compression because the macro environment changed and you had looser monetary policy and looser financial conditions. So, I'd need to know not only the trajectory of earnings looking into 2020, specific to the trade war, et cetera, but also what do the financial conditions look like?
Yeah, of course. I mean, the rates of change of those financial conditions drive the earnings, too.
I mean, but I think we've gotten as much multiple expansion off the back of macro conditions as we're going to get.
Yeah.
I think I've been calling this environment we're in sort of moments of truth. I think we're within our sights, we're going to get some answers to a lot of these burning questions.
Yeah.
Given that macro does not support much more multiple expansion and E has to start doing more of the heavy lifting, what does that actually look like in 2020? For now, we've had this bifurcation between the manufacturing recession and services or consumer hanging in there. We're starting to see some cracks in that dividing line, as mm-hmm. is typically the case, through the employment channels. I think we'll get a greater sense of that. We saw the crack in ISM services employment, but we'll have a better sense of that. So I think it's always a crucial month or two in the world of markets, but mm-hmm. I think whether it's trade or bifurcation, I think we're going to get some answers that I think help clarify some of this uncertainty.
That's interesting because I rarely give a specific like 4 to 6 weeks. In the next 4 to 6 weeks, we're really going to see the whites of the eyes on this.
I think trade, mm-hmm. Brexit, we'll have more data
earnings.
We'll have more data on what we've seen, some of these cracks between
right.
the business side and the consumption side or the manufacturing side and the services side. But as you know, you can have contractions in the economy without consumption going negative.
Yeah.
You know, I think three out of the last seven recessions, consumption stayed positive. If mm-hmm. you just look at negative GDP quarters and you compare sort of gross business investment versus consumption, is gross business investment goes down most of the time you end up negative GDP quarter, mm-hmm. but about 60% of the time consumption stays positive.
Yeah, you're coming from such a high base, it's almost mathematically impossible.
Well, and it's also the manufacturing side of the economy, the CapEx side of the economy, the multiplier effects, the filter effects are bigger. So it's not as simple as saying, okay, manufacturing is only 12% of the economy, ergo, it doesn't matter what happens there. As long as we have a healthy consumer,
yeah.
we're fine. For now, we have been fine if you're fine with, 2% growth.
Yeah.
But I think we have within our sights maybe an answer as to whether we're going to keep that dividing line firm.
Yeah, it's one of the favorite things for people to say, but the consumer is fine. You could say that 100% of the time at the end of every cycle. On slide 54, guys, if you guys could show, I just want to show what Lizanne said, because I don't think people have as much appreciation for what she said in terms of the PE expansion that we've seen this year. So what we're showing here is this versus the Russell forward PE year to date. And it's bananas, actually. I mean, it truly is game time on this metric where we're, I mean, this is what's happened, forward PE year to date. So you've had a massive expansion in earnings expectations. In the Russell's case, the return has been horrendous looking back to the peak cycle of where the Russell peaked back, obviously, in August of last year. So that's where a market starts to look extremely expensive because the E is falling down at a much faster rate. And the Russell is like, I'm not willing to chase anything that's, I mean, the return on the Russell is horrendous, relatively speaking.
The one tactic, well, being neutral is not a chicken position to be in, although you can't really be dead wrong when you're telling clients to sort of stay at the normal allocation. But I still feel pretty confident in the overweight, large cap, underweight, small cap.
It's a great,
cap.
I mean, it's...
Other than the valuation discount on some metrics, at least for the Russell 2000. But the fundamentals of small caps, be it the percentage of zombie companies, the high percentage of debt. If you remember, fourth quarter 2017 was a big burst kind of relative performance of small caps under the assumption that, well, they're bigger beneficiaries of the tax cut because they have a higher tax rate. The problem is the record percent at that time didn't have profit. So I don't care what your tax rate was or what it goes to, you don't benefit if you don't have profits to tax. So that was sort of the knee-jerk reaction, and then, a minute.
Yeah, but I mean, it's really, you could see, actually go to the next slide, you could also see, it's almost like she's read my slide deck, which she probably has.
No, I haven't, I promise.
But this is Wally world in this regard. I mean, of course, some Russell-based names are going to look cheap because NTM Russell earnings are here, and S&P is like saying there's a chance. Yeah. I mean, this, by the way, has never happened before. Where, so if you're long bigger cap, because they haven't guided down yet, doesn't mean that they don't have to.
Right.
So I wonder, I mean, if this puppy starts to dive toward anywhere near that, I mean, that to me is the Uber bear case from here, and you don't have to have a recession.
Right.
You have GDP, and I have GDP at 2 on a year-over-year basis, with earnings down 5 to 8. So I still wonder if the biggest thing that surprises people is, oh, today's not JP Morgan day, it's more like Goldman Sachs day. Like those two stocks today are completely different than one traded FIC pretty well during a big repo move. One, got smoked by being long too much of Uber. So it really does get down to what do you own underneath some of these things. And that's, to me, I think that that'll be an interesting thing.
Well, there's clearly recent history of having an earnings recession without an economic recession.
Yeah, 2016.
Second half of 2015, first half of 2016, four consecutive quarters in a row.
Yeah.
Now, that was much more concentrated in energy,
yeah,
given the collapse in oil prices. This, if we go into some semblance of earnings recession, it's certainly broader in terms of the contributors to why earnings are weak.
Yeah, guys, show slide 73 on that. Just the last one that I'm going to show before. I want to make sure we get questions for you because I'm on the clock. But this is like, again, if people don't know this, they should know. Obviously, most of macro is being aware to start, and then we can come up with an opinion. But this is S&P 500 earnings growth going back to the point that encyclopedic and sounding pretty good, by the way, with when she's under the weather. This is what it was. Aggregate S&P 500 earnings growth finally bottomed in Q1 of 2016. That's where you should have bought a lot of stocks. But again, it wasn't a broad, all these sectors, most of these sectors were positive, okay? Then you go on this massive run where everything's positive, everybody's a winner at the peak of the cycle. Now in the most recent quarter, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 out of 11 sectors are negative. Q3, it's starting to broaden. So that's basically my concern. And if the market looks through that, it could be looking way ahead, because then, of course, next year, those are really easy comparisons.
Right.
But still, I've not seen a company really go up on a big earnings guide down when they haven't yet guided down.
And also, what truly is the validity of 2020 estimates, given how little adjustment there has been for the obvious number one uncertainty, which is trade?
Yeah.
And I don't blame analysts for not making those adjustments. We're all kind of at the mercy of tweets. And,
of course.
So I think it is exacerbated, not just short-termism in terms of market behavior, but forced short-termism in terms of the analyst community being able to look out and legitimately apply the data to numbers.
It's also a crutch. I mean, the non-trade war or trade war didn't drive tech earnings and comms and financials earnings up 25 to 30% last year.
Right.
They're slowing because they have to lap that. That has nothing to do with trade war. You know,
well, it's just why 2019 also has been weak, because the comps against 2018. It's a simple math associated with a tax cut that starts at the beginning of 1 year.
So
we were, even before all this trade stuff, we were saying, look, 2019 is not going to look pretty.
Right.
It's really just simple math.
Well, thanks for doing that, because most people are now, they think that that's everything. And it's just classic Occam's razor, where people just need something so simple. When it's the cycle itself,
right.
Chinese stimulus 2016, got these numbers to go from negative to positive, tax reform 2017, you know, that's all the comparison. So it'll be interesting to see how, you know, how this all plays out. How about on, you spend enough time on CapEx. CapEx is now moderately negative on a year-over-year basis.
Yep.
What do you see there in terms of a leading indicator?
So I think that absent a comprehensive trade deal, which I think a true comprehensive trade deal.
You didn't think that was Friday?
No. Well, you know, when the comment is, we have a deal contingent on it being written.
Phase one of it being written.
Phase one of it being written. You know, absent a comprehensive deal, which I think the chances of that round down to something around zero, meaning, you know, full attention to intellectual property theft and bias towards state-owned enterprises, actually having enforcement mechanisms and monitoring mechanisms, that doesn't appear to be happening. You know, China's basically said that they don't seem to have much incentive for that. So you get some sort of skinny deal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there'll be victory laps taken, perhaps, but I can't imagine that under those circumstances you reignite animal spirits and kick back in the CapEx cycle. If you are, you know, a corporate manager in charge of those long-term fixed investments, and you've had trade uncertainty as the factor behind not doing that, you know, a skinny deal is not going to say, all right, we're fine now, off to the races. So I don't think that represents scrutiny. The only potential lift would be, with correlations having come down, non-U.S. is now leading the U.S. in terms of certainly the manufacturing cycle. So if these kind of nascent green shoots that we're seeing, the finally stopping what was a 17 or 18-month decline in global PMIs, if that's instead not just kind of bouncing around the bottom, but you get a little bit of a lift, that could eventually, with a lag, start to pull up the U.S. But I think CapEx does not represent the next leg in this cycle.
Mm-hmm.
So then it's just a question of, you know, a beleaguered CapEx environment. Is the consumption side going to remain strong enough to kind of keep us, you know, in positive territory?
It was a big part of the cycle. I mean, particularly on, you know, places where I think you have the frothier multiples, which is software. You know, when you're allowed to call discretionary technology spending a full-blown 100% depreciation tax or tax deductions, I mean, you've seen these bubble multiple 15 to 20 times revenues for companies that, you know, nobody had heard before. Again, you know, maybe experience in seeing that before gives me a bit of a bias, but it's really just a sine curve. They're uncompable comps.
Yeah.
And CapEx in that component of, if you just take out the disaggregate CapEx, it's already slowing. Yeah.
The other thing that happens specific to CapEx, and this doesn't get discussed as much as I think it should, obviously one of the stated purposes of having tax cuts be not just on the individual side but the corporate side was to kind of unleash this money and incent it to go into capital spending. The rub, though, and it's almost like this sort of circular thing, you wonder whether parts of the administration aren't just talking to each other. So you do this tax cut on the corporate side and the individual side, which stimulates consumption, or is the goal is to stimulate consumption. Whether you like it or not, we are a trade deficit nation, which means both on the individual side and the corporate side, we spend more, we widen out the trade deficit, because we buy more imported goods than we do domestically produced goods. So you do this tax cut, you get a little bit of a lift in CapEx, but the trade deficit widens out, yet that's being used as a rationale for tariffs and a trade war, which in turn then disincentivizes business investment. So it's like this weird...
Yeah, you're in the wash machine.
Within 2 months, we sort of negated what was supposed to be the benefit of the corporate tax cut by a tariff war that disincentivized the CapEx that was supposed
that's just bananas. It makes me like, and then if I layer it in the, like, just say you took a 50% chance Trump doesn't win and you truncate the whole tax reform on top of what you just said. I mean, I don't think the series of outcomes within a year could be so wide relative to what I think I see today. Because I have no idea on that. I mean,
we have no idea, and it's not as simple. I'm getting questions all the time now about, all right, what would a Warren presidency mean? Well, it depends on, first of all, what her platform looks like going into it, but more importantly, most importantly, what's the makeup of Congress?
Yeah.
What does the House look like? What does the Senate? Only when we get a sense of that can, you know, Schwab's Washington people and everybody else out there start to say, okay, what does this actually mean for policy?
Yeah.
Until then, we have no idea.
The only thing I have 100% certainty on is if you truncate tax reform, this earnings picture is going to be bloody red right across the board, across
all
sectors.
It'll be ugly.
You know, 94% of U.S. companies are LLCs, pass-through entities that, you know, plenty of people took their full 100% depreciation.
Right.
So if it goes from, you know, we the people that have money and people, I mean, this wealth transfer, whatever, it's gonna, that part I think the market would pick up on it.
And that I think obviously becomes a risk if the, you know, the entire three branches of government move to the left. There's checks and balances, especially as it relates to things like tax reform, if one or both of houses. So then it, you know, if you keep sort of the Congress divided as it is now, but you get somebody on the more progressive end, I think the calculus is more, okay, what does it mean probably more importantly for regulatory policy? Because there's more ability to move the needle at the executive branch than there is on things like tax reform. But it's just too early. Not to kind of trade on any of this
stuff.
Well,
I think it's, I mean, and I want to get your questions. We have about 10 minutes left to take questions for Lizanne, so fire them in the queue. There's a shocking amount of complacency, or not, I don't know if complacency is the right word. I live in Westport, Connecticut. You live in Darien, Connecticut. This isn't exactly hopping Republican territory. But very few people, if they work in our business, will just openly tell you that Trump's no way he's going to win again. In fact, most people, Republican or Democrat, on the institutional investing side, are either hoping he wins or think he's going to win subliminally, overtly, or not. I mean, I think if the market believed that he was going to lose, it would trade quite differently.
That I don't know, because there was a lot of people that thought we'd have just a crash if Trump
won.
Some thought it would. Some viewed it the other
right,
way.
Right, that's fair. That's
so
fair.
I don't know. I don't try. But what we try to do with all this stuff is stay out of the partisan muck.
Yeah.
And I'm a registered independent, so
nice.
I can actually be sort of a bipartisan critic of Washington. I think, you know, many on both sides do an awful job at times. But what we have to do, especially on these hyper-partisan issues like trade, is just say, okay, we're not going to make a comment as to whether we think this is the right tack, the wrong tack. Will it work? Will it not work? How do you define it working versus or winning versus not winning? But just kind of put blinders on and say, all right, we're in it. So what's the impact?
Right.
And that's how I think we're going to approach the next year.
Mm-hmm.
Not deflect a lot to our Washington policy people and just say, leaving sort of views aside, what does this actually mean?
Yeah, 100%.
And that's how we have... how we approach, especially in this hyper-partisan world.
And thank you for that. You know, because that was just me feeling, you know, what I'm feeling in these meetings. Because clearly our nowcasts feel nothing. Like what quad we're going into and what asset allocation factor and sector style that I want has literally what to do with the last number that was reported.
Right.
And I think that's, you know, I obviously think that that's a better way to do it.
And speaking of the last number reported and the nature of how information is disseminated these days, I think that the stock market has become much less of a leading indicator than it's been in the past.
Well, I mean, if only because it's diverged from every other indicator, i.e. bond yields, currency markets, et cetera.
Yeah.
It's an interesting one. All right, 6 minutes here for questions. I want to make sure we get Lizanne on the right clock. Lizanne, thanks for your perspective as always. Help me understand your process on how you decide your overweights versus underweights.
So, you know, there's the macro level of just overweight, underweight, or neutral overall equities. And we do it at the U.S. equity level and emerging markets and developed markets. Outside of the U.S., that's as far down as we know. We don't go into sectors. And it's not a quant-driven model. It is, it's subjective. It's subjective. I sit on part of our asset allocation team. You know, ultimately, it's my bailiwick on the U.S. side, both the economy and the markets. So it's a function of a lot of the similar cycle analysis that you do, a lot of investor sentiment woven in, both on the attitudinal side and the behavioral side. Growing up in this business, working for Marty Zweig, I was steeped in, you know, the behavioral side of investing. Obviously, you know, monetary policy, investor liquidity, all of those factors come into play. And to be perfectly honest, there's also a dose of kind of gut instinct in there as well. The same thing with regard to large cap, small cap, which we will make recommendations. We do not do overweight or underweight recommendations specifically on growth and value, because I think there's an important distinction between the fundamentals of growth and value and the index labels of growth and value.
Yep.
I think there's times like 2002, the best place to find value was in the tech stocks. They weren't all of a sudden housed in the Russell Value Indexes, but that's where you found value.
Yeah.
So we will talk about the fundamentals of growth and value, but we don't just make a blanket recommendation, because we don't want investors to say, oh, well, she said she likes value, so I'll just load up on all the value stocks.
It's a good thing you do it that way, because we've back-tested the batting averages on growth versus value, and it's almost like, you know, it's Brownian motion. I mean, I'd much prefer what quadrant. Love you, Lizanne. Please tweet more, was a comment, by the way.
It's not my full-time job on Twitter, so I feel sometimes people say, where have you been? It's like, well, it's a publishing day, or I'm on a plane, I'm traveling.
This is kind of an interesting question. What do you think of the IMF downgrade on global growth? That's kind of like yesterday's
Duh.
News. But do you think there could be stagflation ahead?
No. I think there could be stagnant growth ahead, but I'm not quite sure where I see, at least in the near term, mm-hmm. where the inflation is coming from.
Mm-hmm.
I think from an inflation perspective, I'm never a contrarian just to be a contrarian, but I do have a devil's advocate voice that, and I'm
really?
Always at least as intrigued by the story no one is telling
yeah.
as I am the story everyone is telling. So I do wonder, okay, there's now such a broad consensus that inflation is dead and buried forever. So the devil's advocate in me says, okay, what could be the scenario, not in the near term, but
yeah.
what could be the scenario that looking longer term that could mean an inflation picture that is not quite as pat as the consensus
yeah.
view? And I think deglobalization may be one of those forces. If we think of that as having been one of the secular forces keeping inflation low globally, what does deglobalization, nationalism,
yeah.
what does that say to the long term, say about the long term trajectory
well,
of inflation?
On
so near term stagflation, no. But muddle through, yeah, that's probably the most likely scenario at best.
Yeah, for those of you that might be asking that relative to our inflation accelerating view, that's just the base effect. So if you go to slide 15,
right.
that's because in Q4 of last year, you had the epic deflation, quad four growth and inflation slowing at the same time. So we basically have, Lizanne, I don't know if you've seen this or not, but this is basically, our call was that inflation was going to go from peak cycle here to here. That's why we bought duration bond proxies. And our nowcast is just saying you're going to get a lift from
right.
this
from
to this.
The basis of that.
But this is,
yeah.
you know, we're talking about, you know, not a lot of, and then by the way, back down.
right.
So it's just.
Yeah, so even at your, you know, 1Q20, if you have slow growth, I don't think it's accurate to define an environment like that as stagflation. Could we have some upside surprises or base effect on inflation? Yeah, but I think to the extent you're talking about kind of true 70s era stagflation.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. I mean, that we could do a whole show on or like a whole discussion on that, because I like increasingly I find myself studying those time series of the 1970s. And it's just like, okay, I just want to be aware.
Right.
Because we don't have that.
Right.
But if we had
right.
it, we do at least have a playbook. Yeah. To go back and consider in terms of asset allocation in particular. Liz, what does lead the next cycle, if not CapEx? What is leading?
You mean going down into a recession, assuming we're getting one, or coming out?
I
so
think
lead on the downside or coming?
Coming out, I could see, I mean, housing's one that's already coming out.
I think housing is fine. I think it represents
yep.
a support.
Yeah.
I'm just not sure in and of itself it's sufficient to...
To lift
you know,
all
yeah,
you know, all
it may actually help keep us from recession-type conditions. I think that, leading in, I worry, as most people do, about something that's a bigger crack in the low end of the investment grade spectrum. And I'm not, you know, I'm not the fixed income person. That's my colleague Kathy Jones, but. When you think about the analogy of when the liquidity tide comes out, you know, who's swimming naked, or you throw a stick of dynamite in the water, the minnows come up first and then the whales later. So, you know, you always have to wonder whether, there are some naked swimmers out there, naked whale swimmers out there. But
there are a lot of naked.
You know, I think if we're heading into a recession, you know, barring some sort of, I think it's more likely to be garden variety than, you know, an epic 2007 to 2009.
Yeah, that, of course, is the trap that people have, whether they're a whale or a minnow. I mean, they're just constantly looking at the prior movie, so they always think
right.
that that's what's going to happen.
Absolutely. It's muscle memory, and it's yeah. recency bias, whatever cute term you want to use for it.
Your maybe last question here. Your best guess on the next Fed move, do you think that there's a chance that they don't go ahead and cut?
Whew. I
had that question more than a couple times.
Yeah, our bias is that they cut, but the language may not be as dovish as what a cut might suggest. So they may offset a cut by slightly less dovish language in the statement.
Because they could go into this the Halloween cut with a Brexit deal and a, you know, I'm using...
Right. So, yeah, so tell me what's going to happen between now and the Fed meeting. And that's the other thing. I think there's still, and I hear it all the time in the nature of questions, there's still this view that the Fed is in some sort of process or they're on some sort of autopilot or have a sense of what they're going to do, and they're just deciding when to drip that information out to us. You know, data dependency is an overused term, but that is the mode they're in.
Yeah.
So when people say, well, what is your outlook for Fed policy next year? I don't know, tell me, you know, fill in these following, you know, 14 blanks, and I'll tell you what the outlook for Fed policy
yeah, if
is.
Yeah, if I took the S&P 500 down by 10% tomorrow in a day and blew out credit spreads, would the Fed be cutting rates or not?
Well, so credit spreads, that's an interesting one. And I think that, if you think back to 10 months ago when Powell gave the well-publicized speech at the Economics Club of New York, where most of the attention at that speech was on the comment he made about, yes, the Fed funds rate is close to the neutral rate, which mm-hmm. was sort of an offset to the September. We're still well below the neutral rate, which was seen as one of the causes for the near bear market. I thought what he said at that meeting that resonated with me, but it didn't get picked up much in the press, that was more important was he said, the Fed, it's important for the Fed to distinguish between financial market volatility and financial system stability. Mm. Basically suggesting financial market volatility, our mandate is not to keep that at bay at all costs. Mm-hmm. If it ultimately starts to concern us about financial system stability, that's a different story.
Yeah.
And I thought that was the most important thing he said. Trying to wean the market off from, you know, any 10% drop, we're going to step in and lower interest rates or start another round of QE. But given that you add credit spreads in there, if you're talking about a blowout in credit spreads and downgrades among the BBB set, then that's a potential financial system stability. So the Fed stepping in that environment would make a lot of sense. If it's simply another short-term riot in the stock market that isn't potentially infecting the financial system, then I think the Fed will be a little more careful under those circumstances.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, I protecting the house on private equity and global credit, I mean, that's clearly something he understands. And he does not want given his background, he does not want to go out with that on his watch, yeah. I don't think. So, you should play Hurt more often,
oh,
by
well,
the way.
You hear it. It's about to go.
So. It's about to go.
It's about to go.
Well, thanks for your time. We
so,
appreciate it.
I don't know sign language, so thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks. Thank you very much. And thanks for your questions. I couldn't get to all of them. Obviously, we're on a bit of a clock here, but she's fantastic as always, and thanks for joining us today. We appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to our podcast. As a reminder, new Hedgeye subscribers may qualify for a special discount on one of our Hedgeye investing products. Email customer service director Matt Moran at mmoran@hedgeye.com. That's mmoran@hedgeye.com. Hedgeye Risk Management is a registered investment advisor registered with the state of Connecticut. Hedgeye Risk Management is not a broker-dealer and does not provide investment advice for individuals. This research does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any security. This research is presented without regard to individual investment preferences or risk parameters. It is general information and does not constitute specific investment advice. Nothing presented herein should be construed as legal or tax advice. This presentation is based on information from sources believed to be reliable. Hedgeye Risk Management is not responsible for errors, inaccuracies, or omissions of information. The opinions and conclusions contained in this report are those of the individual speaking and not necessarily those of Hedgeye, and are intended solely for the use of Hedgeye Risk Management's clients and subscribers. In reaching these opinions and conclusions, the individuals expressing those opinions and conclusions and their employees have relied upon research which is based upon sources considered credible and reliable within the industry. Neither Hedgeye Risk Management nor any individual expressing those opinions and conclusions are responsible for the validity or authenticity of the information upon which it has relied.